tell us a little bit about ESO. Just remind us what ESO is.
ESO is the European Southern Observatory. It's an intergovernmental organization that provides world-class astronomical facilities for European astronomers and also facilitates astronomical collaborations and other projects. Our headquarters are based in Garching near Munich in Germany, but we actually operate our sites, as the southern in our name might suggest, in the southern hemisphere, specifically in the Chilean Atacama Desert, because it turns out that this is a fantastic place to do astronomy.
And the facilities that ESO operates, can you list them off?
Sure. I mean, essentially, we're operating observatories at three sites in the Atacama. So the original site is a place called La Silla, which is a 2,400-meter-high mountain. And then we have what can be described really as our flagship facility at a mountain called Paranal. This is slightly higher, 2,600 meters. And that's where the Very Large Telescope, or VLT, is located. So some of your listeners may already be aware of this, but it's actually a telescope consisting of four 8.2-meter optical and infrared telescopes and also four smaller auxiliary telescopes, which really makes it the world's most advanced optical observatory.
It's exciting. It's wonderful. When we think about telescopes being large, when we think about these 8-meter telescopes, and that in itself, a single 8-meter telescope is a remarkable achievement to have a telescope that large. VLT is four.
Absolutely. It's fantastic, and it really is an extremely productive science machine for doing astronomy. But, of course, you say that 8.2 meters is large. It's large if you're talking about optical and infrared wavelengths, but as I'm sure you know, of course, at Jodrell Bank, when you actually want to go to longer wavelengths towards the radio, then actually the size of the telescopes becomes much, much larger.
Now, it isn't just a collection of four telescopes which comprise the VLT. The VLT has got a special party trick, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's what we call the VLT interferometer, or VLTI. Essentially, what you do is you combine the light from two or three of these telescopes at a time, and you can combine the light in such a way that you have some of the effect of having a single telescope as large as the combined telescopes. So, for example, if you have two telescopes a couple of hundred meters apart on the mountaintop, you can combine that light, and you can do some of the kinds of scientific observations that you would ordinarily need a 200-meter telescope to do.
It's fantastic, isn't it? And this is an example of interferometry, the physical process of interferometry, aperture synthesis for the aficionados of in our audience. And it's something which the radio guys have done, you know, routinely for quite some time. Why is it so much more difficult in optical wavelengths?
The main thing with interferometry is you have to combine the light, whether you're talking about radio waves or infrared light, and you have to combine it coherently. In other words, you need to preserve the phase information. Now, this means that when you're doing this, everything has to be precise to within some small fraction of the wavelength of light. So if you've got some path lengths in there, if you have some separations between components or between the telescopes, you really need to control it down to some small fraction of the wavelength that you're concerned with. Now, if you're doing radio waves, that wavelength can be relatively long, in which case, well, it's not easy, but the technology is there to do this. As you go to infrared light, then what you have to do is these tolerances become much, much tighter. And so, again, as I say, it's certainly not easy at radio wavelengths either, but you have different technological hurdles that you have to overcome if you want to do it at infrared wavelengths.
The required precision is much, much higher for the optical wavelengths compared to radio, and I guess it's simply we've only just learned how to do that for optical wavelengths.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the VLT at the moment is doing infrared interferometry, so optical is even harder.
And another type of interferometer, which ESO is a flagship instrument for ESO, is ALMA. Tell us a little bit about ALMA.
Well, ALMA, this is actually what I was alluding to earlier, where I talked about the telescopes getting even bigger as you go to these longer wavelengths. So ALMA is the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, and the millimeter submillimeter part of that name is referring to the wavelength that we're looking at. So instead of looking at optical or infrared light, we're now going to what we call, say, submillimeter or millimeter radiation. So the wavelengths are around this length. This puts you somewhere in between infrared light and, say, microwaves. The Atacama part of the name of ALMA is because we're also building this in the Atacama Desert. And the last part, the array, refers to the fact that this is also an interferometer. In other words, we have a series of individual antennas, as we call them at radio wavelengths, individual telescopes, if you want to think of it like that. But we combine them together to make a single telescope, a single machine for making our observations. But Whereas the VLTI combines two or three of these telescopes, when you're with ALMA, we will actually have a total of 66 high-precision radio antennas that we're spreading out over a plateau in Chile called Chajnantor. And this is, in fact, the third observational site that I referred to where ESO is working. We already have a single-dish submillimeter telescope that we're operating there called APEX, the Atacama Pathfinder Experiment. But we're currently building ALMA right now in collaboration with partners in North America and in East Asia.
Now, we've had radio interferometers in the past, we spoke about that earlier, and the ALMA array looks pretty similar. Why is ALMA different to previous interferometry experiments?
Well, in fact, the answer is very similar to what we were talking about before. The wavelengths that we're dealing with, although they can be thought of as radio waves, they're very short. They're around about a millimeter. So this is significantly shorter than the original radio interferometry telescopes that were built. So again, the tolerances are much tighter. Technologically, it's very difficult. The other thing is that if you want, some radio telescopes, of course, can even observe through cloud. But if you want to do submillimeter astronomy, the real killer is the water vapor in the atmosphere. So you have to go to a high, dry site. It turns out that the Chajnantor Plateau in Atacama is fantastic for this. It's 5,000 meters high. It's very, very dry because the Atacama is very probably the driest place on the planet. And so there's very, very little water vapor there. The conditions are absolutely fantastic for submillimeter astronomy. They're not so fantastic for living, unfortunately. So you have very, very harsh environmental conditions. So not only do you have all of the tolerances of being able to do interferometry at millimeter and submillimeter wavelengths to overcome, but also you just have to build these antennas that have to live in really a very, very harsh environment. So it's an incredible engineering challenge, but it's going to be an absolutely wonderful telescope when it comes online.
So we're observing in a new wavelength range with a new instrument, and typically that brings us new discoveries. What do we expect to learn about the universe using ALMA?
So one of the things about submillimeter astronomy is that you can think of it as looking at the cold universe. If you imagine objects with temperatures of, say, several thousands of Kelvin, say, stars or whatever, you're looking there at optical wavelengths, at visible light. If you're looking at, say, particles, I don't know, dust or whatever, at a few hundred Kelvin, then you're looking typically with infrared wavelengths. But if you want to go colder than this, down to things that are maybe only at a few tens of Kelvin above absolute zero, then you go to a slightly longer wavelength again, and this puts you right in this millimeter and submillimeter regime. So ALMA astronomy is going to be, on one side, it's going to be looking at the cold universe. So we're looking at cold clouds of gas and dust out there in space, typically, for example, the clouds of gas and dust that form stars. But another thing that we can look at is light from extremely distant galaxies from way back in the early stages of the universe that has then been redshifted into this submillimeter regime. So it's extremely exciting. We're going to be looking in a sense at cosmic origins, the origins of the universe, and also the origins of stars and therefore solar systems and planets and so on.
Yeah, very exciting stuff. When can we expect ALMA to be fully operational?
Well, fully operational will probably be around maybe 2012, 2013, but we're hoping that there could be some early science coming out of it, perhaps as early as 2010. So as I say, it's under construction at the moment. We've got some of the antennas are already arriving at Chajnantor. They're currently at an intermediate site before being moved up to the high plateau, and they're working now on checking these out and making sure that everything's going ahead. And it really is a hive of activity there. There's the buildings being constructed that will be forming part of the observatory. And we recently, in mid-February, took delivery of a couple of fantastic beasts. They're these giant yellow transporter vehicles that we use to move the antennas around because we want to be able to reconfigure the array of antennas on the plateau. We have 66 of them, but we want to be able to move some of these around to different positions in order to improve our interferometric observations. So the problem is these antennas, each of them, well, the large ones are 12 meters in diameter, so they're big radio dishes, 12 meters in diameter. They weigh well over 100 tons, and we want to move them, and we want to move them in such a way that we keep the precision down to, once we put them back down, that we know where they are to within a fraction of a wavelength. So we've built a couple of fantastic transporter vehicles, which themselves are something like 20 meters long, 10 meters wide, 6 meters high. They've got huge numbers of wheels, and they trundle across the desert, and they can pick up these antennas, put them on their backs, move them to a new position, and put them back down again. So it's not just antennas, it's not just the telescope, but there's just all these wonderful facets of the observatory that are gradually coming together.
That's great. That's some company vehicle. Have you had a chance to drive one of these things yourself?
I haven't had a chance, unfortunately, but I'm told that it's actually very easy to drive, despite the technological wizardry that's gone into it, and also despite the incredible power in there. So, yeah, I'm told it's pretty simple to drive, and actually it's surprisingly nimble and nippy.
You pop off down the mountain for lunch in one of these things, I'm sure will create quite a stir.
Well, it's probably not quick enough to do that, and besides, you know, we need them for the telescope, but it must be wonderful to drive them.
You mentioned moving the elements of the array around to improve the interferometric properties of the telescope. Why would you want to do that? I mean, obviously improving the performance of the telescope, the interferometer, is a good thing, but presumably the further away you move the elements, the better your resolution of your interferometer. Why would you want to decrease, for instance, the size of one of the arms and the interferometer?
Well, essentially, it's true that if you move the antennas further apart, then in principle the finest detail, the finest angular resolution that you can resolve is basically governed by the longest baseline, in other words, the longest distance between the elements. But sometimes you're not necessarily wanting just to get the fine details. As you move them around, you can reconfigure the array such that perhaps you're not getting the finer details, but you're more sensitive to different structures on different angular scales in the sky. So you can think of it really as having a zoom lens. So it's great to have a telephoto lens, but you don't always want to be looking just at the finest details. Sometimes you want to be able to change the kind of observation you're doing. So this is one of the reasons why we'll do this. You can reconfigure the telescope to make a different kind of observation.
Now, also at the VLT site, ESO have built a fantastic place for the astronomers to stay, which is called the Residencia, isn't it?
Absolutely. The Residencia is a little bit down from the mountaintop, and it's there because we have astronomers and other staff who are working at the telescope or people who are visiting the telescope. But this place is, as I say, it's in the middle of the Atacama Desert. It's the driest place on the planet. The humidity regularly drops down to 10% or below, so it's really quite unpleasant outside. It's great for astronomy, but not so great for living. And so the Residencia is like a hotel for the people to stay at, and it really is a fantastic building. If you take a look at it, you'll see it's sort of, in order to avoid disturbing the area too much, it's partially buried underground. And inside, when you go in order to keep the humidity up when you're inside the building, we have a tropical garden and also an actual swimming pool under a giant glass dome. And the reason we do this is to have an open body of water so that the water can evaporate into the air and keep the humidity up. So it's not just for swimming.
And we hear that the Residencia has been used for something else quite recently.
Absolutely. We've just had the James Bond film crew for the new James Bond movie Quantum of Solace have been visiting Paranal, and they've been using the Residencia as one of the locations. So they've been filming there, and it's been extremely exciting.
So you've had all the cast that we'll see, like...
Daniel Craig has been there. We don't know the precise details of exactly what was being filmed, of course, because as with all of 007's missions, there's a lot of security and secrecy around.
Well, you may do, but you'd have to kill us.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wouldn't want to do that. So they've been using the Residencia essentially because it is such a fantastic and unusual building, and they thought this would be ideal as a Bond villain's lair, essentially.
We look forward to that. That's released at the end of October, I think in the UK,
yes.
And in November in the rest of the world. So we'll look forward to seeing ESO's Residencia on that film. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.